little earlier, Adelaide Tambo spoke to us about fighting apartheid in her native country of South Africa, and she asked that we pass along her regards to the man who is with me now, Ezekiel Emfulele, who had been her teacher. Like the Tambos and the Mandelas, Emfulele has spent his adult life speaking out against the minority white rule in South Africa. He is a writer who says that he stopped writing the escapist fiction that he developed in his early career to write a fiction of protest. In the late 50s, when his actions and his writing provoked banning orders that made it virtually impossible for him to do meaningful work, he left for Nigeria. It took him a year to finagle a passport. When he left, he was warned by South African officials not to speak out against his country. But he continued to speak out and to write. He wrote fiction. He wrote an autobiography about growing up in a South African ghetto. And he wrote numerous essays on such subjects as racism, the white man's image of the non-white in fiction, the black man's literary image of himself. Emfulele spent his years in exile in Nigeria and the United States. He taught at the University of Pennsylvania from 1974 to 1977, and later in 77 he decided to return to South Africa, where he's currently teaching at the African Studies Institute at Witwatersrand University, which is the major English language university in South Africa. He also teaches comparative literature there. He has returned to the University of Pennsylvania this week to accept an honorary degree and to address the graduating class. Ezekiel Emfulele, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air and welcome you also back to Philadelphia.
Thank you.
I'd like to talk with you a little bit about different parts of your life and how your writing and your political views have developed. You first left South Africa in 1957 and you went to Nigeria. What made it impossible for you to stay?
That is to stay in South Africa.
Yeah.
Back in 1950, the government came out with a commission of inquiry report on what was then called native education, and it was later to be called Bantu education. The report recommended, among other things, that the education for Africans should not create expectations in the African that could not be fulfilled, such as living in a white man's world and also being able to compete with a white man. Now, there were other pastures. Those are pastures that you could never be able to graze in. So the education was meant to lower the standards of expectation and also the academic standards. And this we campaigned against as a teachers' organization. I was then secretary of the organization. The president and myself and the editor of our journal went around from one part of the country to another to speak against the system that was being recommended among teachers and among parents and among students. And it was in the middle of this that the government fired us from teaching and prevented us from teaching anywhere else in the country. That is the three of us. Later, of course, many other people were summarily dismissed. And it is something an African teacher cannot contest any dismissal at all in any court of law. That has been the tradition in the country. So as I couldn't teach, and I did one, this was in 1952, as I couldn't teach anywhere, and I did one odd job after another and even went into journalism and worked for Drum magazine, which is a pictorial magazine circulating mostly among black people. I worked for them for 2.5 years, but still felt that I wanted to go back to the classroom. And the only way out was to leave. When I packed up my things with my family and we were left for Nigeria to teach at the University of Ibadan.
You have written that when you got there, you had to learn how to not live any longer with an underdog mentality, and you had to learn how to live in a place where you could be free. What was that process like for you?
It was a very weird kind of process. Coming into a social climate of that kind, and it was still colonial. Nigeria hadn't got its independence yet, so we... And yet, at the same time, people were simply were freer, and they had a large sense of life. and a theatrical sense of life. And also, I was able to move about wherever I wanted to for the first time, whereas in South Africa, my movements were limited by the kind of document you carried as a black person called a pass, and which limited your movements by day and by night, and also which also determined where you should work and where you should live. And this was not the case in Nigeria. And also, people themselves were very generous. I found Nigerians are very generous people, and also most receptive of a number of ideas from outside. And here they had a South African whom they were interested in, and they wanted to hear so much about what was happening in the country. That was a kind of freedom. But the awkwardness or awkwardnesses that occurred had a lot to do with my own personality, where very often I expected resistance, or I expected indifference, or even hostility from the whites who still lived, the white expatriates who still lived in Nigeria, as they had been living there throughout the colonial period. And yet there wasn't any such hostility at all. And it left me in a state of unease, because I was always used to resistance from white people in South Africa. It also left me with a kind of void, because now I didn't need any kind of stimulation from a white and a black-white encounter. I had to go on my own steam, as it were, and that was pretty awkward. That is, I wasn't always pushed from behind. I had to simply go on my own steam, and I didn't have that kind of spur that comes from racial hostility for you to want to do things. And I was left very much to myself, to my own resources and my own personality. And that is how I had to readjust.
I'm sure one of the decisions you had to make was whether you should take advantage of the freedom offered to you in Nigeria by pursuing a more abstract or intellectual research of your own,
right,
or to use that freedom to speak out freely against your native country. How did you balance that for yourself? What did you do?
I did both. I wrote a number of articles for the Nigerian press about South Africa. And also at the same time, tried to improve my own academic status. I had a Master of Arts when I left South Africa. And I was, for the first time, introduced to African literature. I had moved out of one literary renaissance in South Africa in the 50s, when there was quite a great upsurge of literary activity. I'd moved from out of that into another renaissance, which is the Nigerian or West African renaissance, where writers were now looming. They were now re-emerging. Writers like Wole Soyinka, J.P. Clark, Chinua Achebe, or Christopher Okigbo, Kofi Awoonor of Ghana, and F.W. Sutherland of Ghana, people like that. And I was involved with them in the literary workshops and also literary discussions and so on. And that gave me it enlarged my own life and increased me. And I always feel Nigeria restored Africa back to me. I had lost it in the South African ghettos and ghetto life. And now I was looking at Africa full face, particularly through the West African arts, three-dimensional art, the painting, the theater, the writing, all these I was surrounded by. And that is, so while I was writing articles about South African life, I was also, as it were, re-educating myself and being introduced to things that I would never have been introduced to otherwise, as South Africa is tucked away, very much tucked away from the rest of Africa.
Well, after your years in Nigeria and then the years that you spent in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania, you mm-hmm. decided to return to South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you do that, knowing that you'd probably not have the freedoms that you had become used to?
Right. After Nigeria, where I lived for 4 years, I went to France for 2 years to direct the African programs of the Congress for Cultural Freedom. And then I went to Kenya for 3 years. And then I came to the United States, the University of Denver, to do my PhD. I then taught, went back to teach at the University of Denver before I came to Philadelphia, the University of Penn. I went to Zambia in the interim also for 2 years. And altogether lived the nine years here. 5 years before I left, which is about 1972, I began to feel restless, and I felt that it's time I go back home. I had accumulated a good deal of experience, and also I felt that I could be more relevant in South Africa among people whose political and cultural goals I could more easily identify with. As a teacher, as a writer, and I've always looked at myself as a teacher and a writer rather than as a public or platform politician, this was what I wanted to do, get back. And I would have to be, I would need to be in contact with people all the time, and I would also, for my own writing, reacquaint myself with the physical landscape and the human landscape, which were beginning to recede farther into the background while I was away. That is, in my mind, I was writing more criticism and poetry than fiction, and I wanted to get back to writing fiction, and that required that I should be more intimately acquainted with the human and physical setting. Which I would not necessarily need to do if I was writing criticism or poetry, some kinds of poetry anyhow. So I decided it was time to go back. When I left South Africa, I had it back in my mind that one day I would want to return. I just felt it in my bones that I wasn't going out for good, and that this was for the interim. And also hoped faintly, or sometimes faintly and sometimes even more convincingly, that the situation was going to change pretty soon. Then Sharpeville came, the massacre of Sharpeville in 1960, and then the Rivonia trial that sent Mandela and other people to Robben Island for life. In prison, in terms of life imprisonment, and I became less optimistic about something happening in the near future. So I decided now it is time for me really just to go back in there, and be part of a process of becoming ready for the day when something radical would happen that would change the lives or transform the lives of my people. And as a teacher and writer, I'd feel that I was on the scene. Out here in America, although I could identify emotionally and intellectually with black concerns, let us say the concerns of radical politics, although I could identify, but it was only emotionally and intellectually. I couldn't really be part of it as an activist. One feels often that the people you find can do things better. And as long as I could only identify at that level, I wasn't contented. And I wanted to be very much part of the history of the people. As I have said elsewhere, that to be involved in any kind of commitment, one needs to feel the history of that commitment. And I didn't feel that history as strongly and intimately as I did the South African history. So I felt that I should go back. So 5 years before 1957, I had already started things in motion, got things in motion to negotiate a return. When eventually I was allowed to return, it was on no, there were no conditions, except that the conditions would be that I would, when I returned, I should seek employment in a black university. As you, there are, since my leaving, five black universities have come into existence. This is to prevent blacks trying to get into white universities. So they wanted already to set that kind of limit that I should seek employment in a black university, which didn't matter to me very much because I wanted to teach in a black university anyhow. It wasn't never my intention to teach in a white university because I didn't think they would need me there. So when I went, when I returned and I did apply for a job as chairman of the English department in the university, black university, I was rejected by the government, and things took a different turn, and I realized that there was a certain effort to keep me out of university, black universities, as I had a partly a South African education and partly an American education. I don't think myself that it was the government that was willing that was rejecting me. I think myself it was the university administration itself that advised the government to prevent me from coming in. And then it would look as if the government it was the government's responsibility, but it wasn't. Well, there I was without a job, and then the University of Witwatersrand, which is an English language university in Johannesburg and also one of the three open universities in South Africa, open in the sense that black students can still go in according to a quota system and also according to the according to government permission. And I had to go and teach there. And as it turned out, it became quite a congenial place to teach in, also with the kind of freedom that one has to operate.
How much freedom do you have to speak out against the government and against apartheid?
Well, as much freedom as anybody else has. The speaking out, you know, in a South African situation has got a number of paradoxes. There are a number of leaders like Gacha Buthelezi, like Dr. Motlana in Soweto, like so many other people speak out, and the government doesn't do anything to curtail their movements or their freedom of speech. But if you are actively, say, involved in a trade union movement or, again, a political organization in South Africa, that is, in the political organizations that do exist, that can still operate, then of course, surveillance becomes sharper. The focus becomes sharper. And if it was felt that the way you speak out was dangerous and that it was inciting other people, then you would immediately be banned or detained for interrogation indefinitely. And I don't even think that it has something to do with my being a professor in a university at all. There's no discrimination at all if they really want to get you. It is simply the context.
Is it that you're an intellectual?
No. It is not that I'm an intellectual. A number of intellectuals who have been detained, who've been banned, a number of them. It is not that. It is a lot to do with this is where I say there are many paradoxes. at some point it must have something to do with the context in which you're saying it, which may be regarded as being dangerous enough. That is, if you have a whole big crowd of people, a constituency, if you had a constituency that followed you and you were able to influence it, that's when it becomes, you're vulnerable. But a person like me who doesn't, I have a whole large undefined constituency in South Africa among black people, and talking matters of education and matters of culture and so on, they would not think that I am in any way particularly harmful. And I don't particularly think that I'm carved out for that kind of work. You see what I mean?
What about your books, though? Are they available or are they banned?
Well, some of my books are banned. Others are not. The African Image, which is the critical essays, that has been banned. Banned for reading as well as banned for possession. That is, nobody would even be allowed to possess it in his house. Not if your book is banned, it may be banned for circulation. That is, public libraries will not display it. Bookshops will not display it. But it may also be banned for possession, in the sense that nobody may have it in his house. The African Image, The Wanderers, which is a novel, was banned. Some short stories were banned. Down Second Avenue wasn't banned, and subsequently a novel hasn't been banned yet, which was published in 1979. And then short stories and poetry that were published last year, those haven't been banned. Mm-hmm.
Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. I'm speaking with Ezekiel Mfulele, who's a writer and teacher who's from South Africa, and he recently returned to that country in 1977 after living in exile for close to 20 years. He taught for a few years at the University of Pennsylvania in the mid-70s and is back in Philadelphia to receive an honorary degree from the University of Pennsylvania. You must ask yourself what meaningful action is in South Africa at this point. And I don't mean like how the government defines you mm-hmm. as a threat or meaningful, but for yourself and for other people who whose lives are so limited from the system in South Africa, what is meaningful opposition? Is it violence? Is it writing? Is it quiet organizing? You must ask yourself this all the time.
Yes, certainly. And I see the struggle in South Africa as one that has many fronts. That is, you can be effective as a writer, as a teacher. You can be effective as a social worker. You could be effective as a person, you could be effective in whatever profession you are, as a nurse, as a doctor, a medical doctor. Depending on the kind of role that you choose for yourself, it has many fronts. It's a broad front. I don't see myself that the liberation struggle is necessarily confined to direct confrontation with the authority, that is, revolution or maybe even passive resistance. There it is, many fronts. And everybody can be useful in the best way he possibly can be. It needs certainly a political consciousness. You need a political constituency, or that is a political organization. You need that. The politician is very much concerned with power, and so he works at it on that platform, right? But there are others who must back up any kind of struggle by being involved in community development, in education programs, and so on. And this is where I am.
In one of your books, you wrote that white liberals in South Africa have been terrorized into submission. And you wrote that you can tell the difference between white liberals and radicals because the radicals are all either imprisoned or exiled.
That's right.
And liberals, you say that they prefer to work within the law.
Well within the law.
But you also say that that's a kind of absurd notion, given what the law is.
It is absurd. It is absurd. People should work within the law because they are constrained to work within the law, not because they choose to do that. The liberal, the white liberal, firmly believes in the effort to uphold the law and not break it. The other man, the radical, will feel that, all right, the law does exist. I'm not going to break the law and simply be arrested. But he will still feel that the law has to be changed. It has to be completely, or else be upset or be liquidated, that sort of thing. And he works toward that goal. But that would be the difference between the radical and the liberal.
In America, in the South, when there were still laws of segregation, the technique that was really effective at the beginning of the civil rights movement was civil disobedience.
Right.
In a country like South Africa, do you think that civil disobedience could be an effective technique?
No, it can't be. It cannot be at all. First of all, the passive resistance has a religious base, and it is not part of African religion at all to be passive. Secondly, it has to be an ideology, and one has to have a kind of historical perspective to it. He's got to have a historical approach to it, and it is not part of our history at all. It has been a history of confrontation. Now, also, it depends very much on the kind of power that you're up against. It's not likely that, for instance, if people threw themselves into the road and trucks were coming by, you know, army or police trucks were coming by, that they would necessarily stop. The passive resistance in a South African situation couldn't work because the other man isn't thinking that way, he doesn't say to himself, "Oh well, you know, I'm not meeting any resistance, therefore I should hold back." He's out to control, after all. And he's got his own motives, and if he wants to maintain power, he has to hold it. Now, passive resistance could only work in colonial situations where the colonial power wasn't committed to living in the country, and the South African white feels committed to live in the country. So it's a different approach altogether, and passive resistance isn't going to work at all.
Do you think that something is going to work eventually?
There are all kinds of answers to this, you know, and I don't want to be categorical about it. All one can say is that there are certain signs that show that one way or another, the thing must break somewhere or it must crack somewhere. You don't tell people to take up guns and be killed. One doesn't do that. It is not right. On the other hand, you say, if the other people are as powerful as they are in South Africa, you have to keep on chipping the block, chipping the boulder piece by piece, and walk towards something, some radical change. One can't be prognostic about it. One can only say the possibilities are, there's one possibility that, for instance, if the ruling class busted and got divided into camps, as is happening now among the ruling class, you now have two violently opposed sides. Well, only apparently so, from their rhetoric, that you have now a divided front to move to work against. And yet I don't see it as that divided. Their ideological is still the same. It is simply the kinds of reforms, quote, reforms, that the conservative side think are unthinkable. Right. But one may say, as time goes on, there will be a shift of power from, say, one section to another, and that the oppressed people can take advantage of that shift and entrench themselves. I'm thinking now of industry. There's industry, for instance, that finds that it is short of manpower because whites originally thought they could carry the industry of the whole country on their shoulders. They don't have enough trained personnel to do that. Industry, therefore, wants to co-opt, wants to employ more blacks, and they need to train them in the skills that they require. That the economics of the country are demanding things that do not always work in the same direction as the direction set by the ruling power for itself, right? So there may be a kind of erosion of something here and an erosion of something there, that sort of thing. I don't know. Nobody will tell you precisely that this is going to happen.
Ezekiel Mfaleli is my guest, and he's a writer and teacher who is from South Africa, lived in exile for close to 20 years, moved back to South Africa in 1977. I think most Americans feel that the apartheid system is inhuman and absurd and despicable. But there's racism within our own culture here in America, which is sometimes more difficult to see and more difficult to understand. You have seen American culture as an African, and I'd like to ask you, if I could, a little bit about what the experience was like for you during the years you lived in Denver and here in Philadelphia as a black African. What did it mean to people, both black and white, who'd meet you as a black person in America before they knew you were African? You know, what are some of the stereotypes that you felt you were exposed to here that were placed on you?
The kinds of racism that I experienced here have been mostly at the personal level, where I came into an institution where people just didn't think alike, and there are those who still despise people because they are black. Then you have to go through, say, one office to another, and you meet that kind of personal hostility, or personal contempt. You feel that in public places, public offices, in the shops. A person may not necessarily call you anything at all, but just by her behavior, the shop assistant, just by her own behavior, could be a rebuff, could show you that she's hostile. Those are the things that I have experienced. Now, anybody who tells me that things are improving in this country and racism isn't that stark as it used to be, I could only say that it is always difficult for the victim to prove that he has been a victim of racism, but he feels it. And this is something that is indefinable, and there's no way in which you can say no, but if you can't show me the concrete evidence, then it can't be so. But the victim feels it all the time in the northern states in this country. The racism is very subtle and works in pernicious ways. In job possibilities or job hunting, things like that. I haven't had to experience that because I've always been invited to places and didn't need to apply first. But the forms of, again, the racism is also, even though not dramatized, it is something that one simply feels, and and also one observes the way people live, the way blacks live in Philadelphia, for instance, that some of the things can only be attributable to racism. So that is what it is. But I have taught in southern universities, you know, say for a week or for 2 days or 3 days or so. I haven't experienced anything like that, but then I haven't lived long enough on those campuses to really study the thing in depth, right? And then what one reads about the kinds of crimes that one reads about, one can impute some racist motives in some of the crimes and also in some of the arrests and in some of the trials as well, the court trials, right? But in any personal way, I haven't been a victim of that kind of open dramatization of racism, but just what I have felt and has made me uneasy.
You said a little earlier that although you empathized with the struggle of blacks in this country, you didn't feel a part of it like you do in African movements, and that was part of the reason why you returned.
Mm-hmm.
Amongst American blacks, I think there's an increasing emphasis on Africa and on ties to Africa as a country and to Africans, to the people who live there. Do you think that that's reciprocated on the part of Africans now? Do you think that Africans feel this growing bond to black Americans?
No, it isn't. I'm afraid to say it is not reciprocated in independent Africa. This is a one-way kind of emotional ties that the black American is involved in. South Africa, on the other hand, responds more readily to a black American than the other African. Because of our history, we in the early part of this century, single black Americans have come to South Africa as scholars and as missionaries who worked in South Africa, and because of that we were exposed then even to black American writing like Booker T. Washington's Up from Slavery and also to the spirituals and the jazz, and we became enthusiasts of American jazz, and the movies also brought through a number of black musical figures to our attention, and we even used to collect a good number of jazz records back in the 40s and 50s. So we respond more readily to black Americans than any other African. Also, there are so many similarities in our race situation between America and South Africa. This is how we have become more readily tuned into black American life, or black American experience, than any other African on the continent. That is the case. This search for roots by black Americans in Africa is only felt on the periphery by the Africans themselves in independent Africa. It is not something that is a talking point. It's not a talking point, and it isn't something that they think they can reciprocate. I think some of it can be attributed to the fact that in independent Africa, the African doesn't think he needs the black American psychologically. He doesn't feel a psychological need for that kind of affiliation. Again, also because they've not been exposed that long to the black American presence.
Since you've lived on both continents, do you feel that it would be a good thing if black Americans and Africans had a stronger stronger bond with one another?
I felt that all along throughout the years of my exile, throughout the 20 years of exile. I felt all along, and I've always tried to urge for this kind of contact. There was a time when Americans, particularly in the 50s, came to Africa, 50s and 60s, came to Africa to do research, to study. And it was mostly white scholars who, for whom there were a number of funds available. And I used to keep asking, why is it that blacks don't come to Africa to do research and so on? And it turned out that they just didn't have the financial means to do so. And that funds were always available to white scholars and not to black scholars. A little different now that blacks are have some access now to foundation monies, which they didn't have before, and they can come through to Africa again, not in any kind of large numbers that I would have expected or I would have hoped for. And I feel very strongly that this is important, that black Americans should come to Africa and see Africa as a reality rather than as a dream or as an idea.
Why is that important?
It is important. Now, why is that important? I think it is important because you to be in touch with the diaspora, you're also in touch with another dimension of the African experience, which we need to know about and which we need to feel. It is this black American experience. And simply as a humanist, I feel that is important. It may have no practical value at all, or no material value, but as a humanist, I feel it's very important that this should happen, this kind of contact. If one asked me, don't you think then you could say the same thing about contact between black and white? Isn't it just as important as between black and black? And I would simply say that for now, Africa does need the black American experience for its own spiritual spiritual growth, because Africa has been colonized, because Africa has been uprooted, because Africa has been invaded by European colonialism, because Africa has got to a point of confusion between traditional values and Western values. It would be a good thing to see what black Americans have gone through.
It's just so interesting to me because I think so many black Americans are looking to Africa for that spiritual connection.
Yes, yes, that's right. They're looking for to Africa for that spiritual connection and spiritual growth. And I think, likewise, in the opposite direction, the African needs that.
I know that in some of your earlier writing, you have expressed a lot of cynicism about the ability of organized religion, Christianity, or Islam, to be effective in social change or in organizing. And you said that religions are as apt to produce tyranny as they are democracy or freedom. Do you feel that way?
I still feel that way, yes. I'm not affiliated to any faith at all. When I left South Africa, I left as an agnostic, and now I'm fully confirmed that African beliefs, African thought and belief is what I'm attached to. It's not an organized religion, because organized religion does bring about tyranny, it brings about bureaucracy, it brings about the whole idea of the head of the church and the politics that go with it, with that idea. And it organized religion and creates a climate for mechanical faith and not a spiritual experience. So African religion is a spiritual experience and not a mechanical faith, a church-going faith, and the baptism and all that kind of stuff that goes with it, right? And also, African religion has a more organic view of life than organized religion, because organized religion tends to be bogged down in its own theological and denominational differences.
When you talk about African religion, are you talking about a sense of identity as an African, or are you talking about religions?
Yes, I'm talking about the spiritual level at which we acknowledge the existence of a supreme being, and a supreme being that is all embracing and it is all penetrating, and all pervasive, and it finds expression in the arts, finds expression in social relationships, and finds expression in external nature as well as in human nature.
You're teaching now at an English-speaking university in South Africa. Can you just tell us briefly what the politics of language are now in South Africa?
The politics of language, that is, what kind of language people speak.
Yeah, like, is there any pressure any longer to speak or to write in Afrikaans?
Oh.
Who speaks English? Are there tribal languages that are still spoken?
There are African languages, there are ethnic languages that are still spoken and are written. And some people write in their own mother tongue, which is an ethnic language, and others write in English. Those who write in Afrikaans are the Afrikaners themselves and the colored people, who write Afrikaans, but that has been weakening. That writing has been hasn't found successors to the people who first began to write in Afrikaans, among the coloreds, I mean. White people, the English-speaking people, and so many other Africans write in English today. And English is still preferred as a medium of instruction for blacks generally to Afrikaans.
You said a little earlier that when you moved back to Africa, you wanted to be able to write fiction and to get in touch with things that you needed to there in order to draw on that for fiction. When you moved to Nigeria, you wrote that you felt the difference between writing in a social climate like Nigeria and one of South Africa. And you wrote, "I now realize what a crushing cliche the South African situation can be as literary material." Mm. Can you explain what you meant by that for us?
Yes, I meant by that as long as one always wrote about the black-white encounter, it becomes cliche because you stop having anything new to say about it. Whereas if one pursued life as it is among black people, which has got its own drama and its own rhythm, that you can still write about the black-white encounter, but at the same time, your focus would be on black life as a substantive thing without always making reference to the black-white encounter, without making the black-white encounter so important that you seem to suggest that people don't live, they don't have their own love life, they don't die, they're not born, they don't get sick, and they don't divorce, or they don't marry, otherwise, so, unless there's a black-white encounter. That's what I was saying.
Do you see yourself living indefinitely in South Africa now?
Yeah, so sadly. I'm still going to continue living there. Nothing is ever going to take me out at all. I just feel I'm committed now to living there and feel I want to live there for the rest of my life. I see it as home, and I see it as my ancestral ground. And as an African humanist, I feel one should be on ancestral ground, and not as it were expire out away from that ancestral ground.
Are you confident that you will be able to continue to have the freedoms that you have now?
I'm confident I will. There is a certain level at which there is a kind of, it is not a radical change, but it is a, it is, I think, it goes along with the Africans, or the black men generally, the black man's effort to diminish his dependency on white people. And that the more that happens, the more the African can stand, can speak from a position of self-pride, and that this is something that will continue to erode this resistance and this this kind of power that we have in front of us. That is important. So I think that's where my hope lies. That the morale of our people can go stronger and stronger, so that it can withstand whatever is in front of it. And that eventually it must break down.
Well, I want to thank you very much for spending part of your short trip to Philadelphia with us on Fresh Air. It's really been so interesting to listen about your life and your views. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a delight for me to talk to you.
Ezekiel Mfaleli has been my guest. He's a South African writer and teacher who left in exile in 1957, returned about 20 years later to South Africa after having lived and taught in Nigeria, France, I think Kenya, Denver, and here at the University of Pennsylvania, where he was from 1974 to 77. He currently teaches at the African Studies Institute at one of the major English-speaking universities in South Africa. He is visiting Philadelphia to receive an honorary degree from the University of Pennsylvania, and earlier this week he addressed the graduating students at the university.